Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Felix Baumgartner's 24-mile freefall the other day was witnessed by no fewer than 8 million viewers on YouTube. And that's an all-time record by a country mile, and it may be a harbinger of things to come. Meanwhile, Microsoft is prepared to unleash a massive marketing launch for Windows 8 of up to $1.8 billion. That's more than either presidential candidate will be spending this fall. But the question is, will all that money be enough to make Windows 8 a hit? There are also issues these days with internet pirates, more folks working online from home than ever before, and records set on Twitter during the first presidential debate. 10.3 million tweets were sent during those 90 minutes. So much to talk about with our techsperts, who once again are in the house. They are Dustin Jacobson. He's Chief Strategy Officer at Flat Square Technology Group. Dustin, always good to have you.
Great to be here.
And Justin Parlett's also here. He's the recently departed Support Systems Administrator here at UMKC. And Justin, this is your last time with us, and man, I hate to see you go.
Yeah, it's very bittersweet. This has been a fun couple of years.
It has been. And you're going where?
Going up to Chicago.
To do?
I'm going to be basically an iOS administrator. So a pretty big company is giving me a lot of money to manage all of their iPads and iPhones.
And they should be.
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
Like I said, it's been a great 2 years. It's been so fun to have you here.
I've enjoyed it.
Well, what do you mean? Before we get rolling today, Justin, tell us about this new robot that supposedly kills weeds on a farm with 98% accuracy.
Yeah, this,
what's this about?
This is pretty cool. I grew up in western Kansas, so I every now and then keep my ear to the ground about what technology in farming is going on. And there's this group called Blue River Technology. And they're a startup that was founded in 2011, and they've just announced $3.1 million in funding from investors.
I saw that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, which is great. What they've done is instead of – they want to replace chemicals for taking care of a weed problem in a farmer's field – and they've developed these robots that essentially just kind of roll through the fields and just decimate the weeds and various pests that are inside of that field without hurting the crop and without using harmful chemicals. It's fascinating.
And they have a bunch of money coming in to develop this new technology.
Yeah.
We'll see where it goes, right?
Well, and the accuracy is mind-blowing. It's 98% accurate. So just having that level of detail is probably better than most of the other, other ways that it's controlled currently. So it's not just that it's better for the environment, but the accuracy is pretty amazing.
Well, this thing catches on. We'll have to talk more about it on this show. But 98% accuracy, that's just that's
and
remarkable.
They're talking about having it perfected and having it be very commonplace by 2016. So that's pretty quick. Right now, it's just working on lettuce. That's the only thing they've been able to get it to work completely accurately on, but they're advancing as they get more money to test and perfect it.
And this obviously would revolutionize farming as we know it.
Oh, completely. I mean, we're talking about a population that's going to be over 9.5 billion by 2050, so food production is going to be huge, and anything we can do to make that process easier, more efficient, and less harmful to the environment probably is going to be a very good deal.
Well, Justin, you also sent me a link about a radical new idea out there. It's called unplugging, which I gather means turning off all your devices for a while and actually sitting down and interacting with your friends. Am I right about that?
Yeah. This idea is kind of taking off right now with people in their 20s. But what they're doing is everybody gets together at a bar or at a dinner or at a coffee shop, they all stack their phones on top of each other so nobody can play around with the phone. So you just see this stack in the middle of the table. And everyone's interacting and having a lot of fun instead of every 5 minutes being like, I better tweet that. And it's kind of cool. We did it last night at one of my going away parties, and it definitely made things pretty easy until people were texting me trying to figure out where we were. That's when it fell apart. But up until that point, it was working out really well. So it's kind of this neat idea. You're just stacking your devices in the center of the table and paying attention to each other. It feels like the 90s again.
Dustin, have you unplugged recently at all? Or
no, but there are more organizations that are instilling a similar practice for business meetings because it's very distractive, right? So you've got, five people, 10 people, whatever, in a business meeting. And, as soon as someone gets a call or gets a text or an email, people are all, you've lost their attention. So more and more companies are kind of instilling this process of no device meetings so that you drop it off, whether it's a basket or whatever, at the door. And in some cases, they'll drop it with, somebody else that's just in charge of managing all those. So if somebody does get a call or whatnot, whatnot. But businesses are under the same challenge that consumers are, which is this immediacy that people feel like I have to be available 24/7.
What is it about us human beings that, you know, you're sitting in a meeting with real people and yet your phone buzzes and one text or one email's come in and suddenly that takes priority over everything else, and chances are the email or text isn't that big of a deal anyway. Why are we looking? I mean, why are we so programmed to look down and figure out what that is?
Yeah, it's really a few things. You know, one is just the whole psychology behind it. People feel that they need to be
on top of available.
Yeah, and on top of things. The reality is that, you know, most of those can wait. And, you know, one of the things that I did is I turned off all my notifications except for text messaging. Now I'm even to the point where I need to turn that off and kind of make the technology work for me instead of, you know, the technology kind of infiltrating
you.
And
yeah.
controlling my life. But that's very common. People are used to that. And they're like, well, email used to be that level of response. And, you know, now we all get a million emails. And then it was text messaging. You know, text messaging used to be like, well, if I really, really need something, I'll text. And now that's kind of almost replacing email in a lot of cases. So it's kind of funny. Now we're actually going back to phone calls or in-person meetings because everyone is flooded with everything else, that the only way you can actually get a hold of anyone anymore is actually either walking up to them in person or calling them, which was, you know, obviously the way this whole thing started.
Well, it is so out of control. My boys, their friends come over sometimes, and their friends walk into the house, never glancing up at mom and dad, just simply looking down at their phones as they walk in. Hey, how you doing? Never even making eye contact. It is just out of control. I mean, I get it, but I don't get it. That's just not right.
Well, and it's not just kids either. I mean,
of course not.
I see adults, you know, in our age group or older doing the same thing. So we all definitely have this moment where I think we're like, oh, it's such a beautiful day outside. I'm going to go out there and stare at my glowing rectangle for a couple hours. It's like, well, okay. Or you're going to take a picture of an Instagram it.
We'll see if our listeners have unplugged lately and done what Justin Parlett has done, which is go into a bar and simply unplugged and stack phones on a table and people actually interacting. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email, UpToDate at kcur.org. You can go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Well, Dustin, tell us about this record-setting number of viewers on YouTube for Felix Baumgartner's death-defying 24-mile freefall. This was a moment, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the high-tech world.
For several reasons. One is that, you know, you don't see many people jump 128,000 feet above the earth. So that by itself was downright amazing.
Just amazing.
Just amazing. So they actually set a new record for YouTube. You know, the previous record, you know, was somewhere around 500,000 concurrent streams. And that had to do with the Olympics. 500,000, that's pretty good. Nothing compared to kind of national broadcast TV, but
right.
for online, that's pretty good. This, like, far surpassed that. This racked up 8 million viewers.
8 million viewers
8
compared
million.
To the 500,000 that
yeah.
was the previous record.
Yeah, so 8 million people were watching this live. Now, the reason for watching it live, you know, there's a lot of different reasons people are watching it. Obviously, the record break was pretty awesome, and
mm-hmm.
just the fear feat of what was accomplished was pretty awesome. Now, I'm sure some people are watching just hoping that the negative happened, which it didn't, which was good. But that just shows how quickly this has shifted. If all of a sudden you have 8 million people watching something live, all of a sudden this now starts to compete with national broadcast TV.
Watching live online.
Watching live online.
As you're pointing out here. And just a reminder, our listeners can watch a point of view video of Felix's free fall on our website, kcur.org. Just go to the UpToDate page. What do you make of this? Is this a harbinger of things to come, Justin?
Oh, completely. I think it shows that the internet as a broadcast method is really powerful, and within the next couple of years, like Dustin said, definitely going to be competing with television. And in fact, I mean, many television devices, many set-top devices that attach to your TV can pick up YouTube, and you can watch various internet streams on your television. And there's content being produced, web series that are being produced that I think are better than a lot of the stuff that's on broadcast television.
Hmm.
Not the least of which is my own zombie show, which is totally awesome.
but what's it called?
Dead Weight.
Dead Weight.
Kansas City-based zombie show. But what's interesting about this 8 million number is that that's actually two numbers that YouTube has put out there, because it's the most number of live streams that they've ever broadcast And it's also the most number of people watching those streams at the same time. So from the back end of it, from the technology standpoint, it's very interesting that they were able to handle that amount of internet
just
traffic.
Having the capability is amazing
just being
in
able
itself.
To put that out, and that was a pretty big undertaking to stream video, especially given all of the circumstances. I mean, this guy's falling from the edge of space. And in addition to that, we have all these computers that are running and broadcasting it.
Was that fall set up so that YouTube that would have this moment? Was the whole thing designed ahead of time to do just what it did?
Well, yeah. I mean, the entire thing was essentially a publicity stunt from Red Bull. I mean, not to take away from the accomplishment.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was – if no one could watch it, then it wouldn't be very interesting for Red Bull.
Yeah.
So, there are several things that it was designed to do. One of them was to be broadcast like this. I don't think they expected it to hit the number of views that they did. But, yeah, they were definitely set up so that they could broadcast this. There were cameras all over the place, and they're all connected to various streaming services. So,
yeah. Well, and again, the point of view video that's on our website is an amazing thing to see if you haven't had a chance to see it. You see the parachute go up and everything else.
Yeah, as long as you're not afraid of heights.
As long as you're
there
not,
should be like a warning on
it. And you do appreciate exactly what he's doing when he takes that off the
balloon. Yeah, I mean, you look down and, you know, you can't really see anything. He's in space, so it's pretty amazing. And he's also the first person to break the sound barrier during a free fall.
Right.
So just the sheer speed that he was falling at is pretty amazing as well.
So do you anticipate more events like this, whether how genuine or how artificial they are, as a way to sort of push the envelope when it comes to online viewing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this one's going to be tough to break.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what else are you going to –
what do you do for an encore here,
right? What do you do for an encore? But, you know, Red Bull has always been involved with these very extreme sports. And
Red Bull is the
– is the energy drink.
Energy
yeah.
drink.
Yep.
The highly – energetic drink.
Yes, yeah. It gives you wings.
Yeah. And they've been working with Felix since, I think, 1988.
A while.
I think they've been working with him for a long time. So this isn't their first rodeo.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. Now, what is next? Maybe the, you know, more kind of space stuff, I think, will get people's attention. You know, jumping, you know, it's kind of the Evel Knievel of today's modern world, right?
Yes.
I mean, everyone's watching, and they're watching for different reasons, but
the Snake River Canyon when I was a boy was, I think, the biggest event in the history of humankind at that point.
Yeah, and 8 million live is pretty impressive. And who knows how many millions of views after the event, because you know, once that kind of took off, then I mean, millions and millions of more people have actually seen that video.
Yeah. We were talking a few minutes ago, Justin was pointing out that there's this new trend out there of unplugging folks getting together at a bar, for instance, and stacking their phones on the table in the middle just to interact with each other, to not be distracted with their phones. Folks calling in, maybe they're experiencing the same thing. Our number again, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, good morning.
Hi, thanks. Great show.
Great.
I, not only being a human being, I'm a business person, and I have found that this exchange of information has reached a level of addiction. People don't, they're losing social skills.
Yes.
In my business, I allow texting only for transmission of information, or if you're in a position where you just absolutely cannot pick up the phone and talk. But otherwise, I put absolute limits on it, boundaries around it, and I insist on an interpersonal connection with the people I do business with. And as a result of that, my business has tripled during the recession, while I've seen competitors go out of business. When it comes to my children and other people, I tell them to shut that thing off and have someone over and actually have a real live interaction. It's becoming very dehumanizing. I mean, at some point you go past the point of information exchange and being well informed to losing, well, who has the show Zombieland? It becomes true. We're a bunch of zombies with actually no depth to us, no awareness, and no real social consciousness. We're just swayed by, I mean, look at Obama. He had one bad debate. It changed the entire complex of the presidential race. Well, that's ridiculous. It should be based on, you know, issues and values and things like that aren't be talking about. It's all turned into just minute-to-minute, moment-to-moment sound bites. So I agree completely with you. There needs to be some boundaries and some etiquette and relearning of social values and basic manners.
All right.
That's it. Thank you.
Chris, thank you. I appreciate the phone call. Bill from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I just tuned in to catch the tail end of the discussion about the putting the phones down. And I'm in my mid-40s, and I used a smartphone for years for business and interpersonal communication, and I got rid of it in favor of a traditional cell phone. I look like a bit of a grandpa compared to my friends, but I find that, number one, I'm able to actually make phone calls with this particular gadget, and second of all, I find myself less distracted and more able to focus on the person I'm talking to or the piece of business I'm dealing with. So I was I make up that your guests are a lot younger than I am. I'm 44, and I was pleasantly surprised to hear that they're putting the phones down as well.
And they're relative babies to me, Bill. So, yes, you're absolutely right about that. But I'm glad to get your phone call. Thanks, Bill. Bye-bye. Let's turn to some developments with Microsoft as we visit with our techsperts here, Dustin Jacobson, Justin Parlett. Lots of things going on with Microsoft. It's going to spend $1 billion or $2 billion on marketing for its latest version of Windows. This is Windows 8. Why so much money on Windows 8? What's going on there?
Well, because they really, really, really want it to be a success. They're looking,
apparently.
Yeah, they're looking at kind of the fiasco that they had back with Windows Vista, and saying we really don't want to repeat that. Windows 7 has been pretty successful for them, and it is a solid operating system.
How long ago did Windows 7 come out?
Oh, Windows 7 was what, 3 years, 2 years now?
Yeah,
a couple
not
years.
Sure.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think they're on a 2 year cycle now. So it hasn't been really long in the grand scheme of things,
yeah.
But in the tech world now, especially with Apple updating their OS every year, it
yes,
seems.
Right.
Microsoft is wanting to go in that direction as well. They've seen how much money they can make off of it. And what Microsoft is wanting to do, Windows 8 really kind of is trying to bring the tablet experience to desktop systems, and then also have it be able to run on their tablets. So
explain that to me. How does that translate exactly?
Okay, well, basically they want to use the same operating system on their computers that they're using on tablets.
Mm.
So they want to bring that experience together so it's in turn easier for end users to be able to move seamlessly between those environments.
So is this a radical change then for folks who are used to Windows 7?
Yeah, you're going to see, especially with the Metro interface, which is essentially kind of an application launcher.
Mm-hmm.
It's an environment that is unlike Windows as you know it now, where you're kind of pointing and clicking on your start menu or the Windows menu and moving around in that environment through Windows Explorer. Now it's going to be more like a tablet where you're tapping on icons to launch applications and launch programs.
Mm-hmm.
So there is going to be a bit of a learning curve if you adopt it new, but hopefully one of the things Microsoft is spending all of this money on is videos educating people and helping them make that transition.
Hmm. What do you make of it, Dustin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, when you look at the distribution of the current operating system, there's still tons of people on Windows XP that have not updated.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really trying, you know, to get past that because one of the challenges for them is supporting so many different versions of their products.
Ah.
So they've got to get people to throw that in the trash and move on because it's just the support costs are just huge for them. So people
yeah.
are still calling, yeah, I've got this, you know, problem with Windows XP, and that, you know, is 10, 12 years old, and they've got to get people beyond that so they can start to focus on moving forward versus just maintenance.
Well, folks who are on XP who are making the jump to 8 at some point, can they do it? Will they need training?
Yeah.
How tricky is this going to be for people of a certain age, if you will, making a transition like this?
Your computer, you're probably, if you have a computer that's running Windows XP on it, it's unless you did that completely by choice relatively recently, your machine's probably not going to be able to run Windows 8 if you've got an older computer. You know, because that operating system XP is, at this point, kind of a decade in.
Yeah.
And really, you see XP more in a lot of enterprise environments. And I think the challenge that Microsoft is going to have is getting those enterprise clients to move into Windows 8, especially considering that it doesn't have the greatest enterprise features for supporting it in a business environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I very recently have had a lot of conversations with my former colleagues about because, you know, we're now in the process of testing that for rolling it out into an enterprise environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of features missing that make it easy for systems administrators to manage a Windows system. If that makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
It's a really consumer-focused operating system coming from Microsoft, which I think is going to be one of the big challenges for them because they are so huge in business that they have to capture that market with
mm-hmm.
Windows 8, or it will be perceived as a failure.
And one thing to keep in mind too is that although, you know, $1.5 billion to $2 billion sounds like a lot, it's not compared to how much their overall revenue is, you know, for that operating system. So when you think about the millions of devices around the world that run, you know, the Microsoft operating system, to put it in perspective, it's not as much as it seems. Versus, you know, if there's someone else saying, yeah, we're going to spend, you know, $1 billion or $1.5 billion to launch a new product, like, wow, that's a lot. But when you put it in the context of their revenue, it's still relatively, you know, normal, I guess.
And to be fair, large portion of that budget for the marketing of Windows 8 is probably tied up in Rolling Stone licensing fees.
Meaning?
Well, when they launched Windows XP, I think it was, they paid like over $1 million for the use of Rolling Stone's Start Me Up.
Oh, yeah.
So they paid a tremendous amount of money for that. And so apparently when he remembers that time period, I thought it was kind of funny.
Well, has the marketing campaign actually begun yet? Are people seeing it on TV or is it about to begin?
No, the official one hasn't really started, but they've been promoting this in regards to, you know, getting your device ready to run Windows 8 or, you know, mm-hmm. with a lot of computers that people are buying now, a lot of times what you'll see is people will wait because they don't want to buy something and then have to upgrade or pay to upgrade the system, you know, 6 months or 2 months later. So a lot of computers manufacturers are figuring out how they can make the computers ready to upgrade and minimize that challenge. Ah, okay. In some cases, even free upgrades to Windows 8.
We're visiting with our tech experts this morning, Dustin Jacobson, Justin Parlett. Microsoft also is trotting out its new Surface tablet computers. How big a deal is this, Justin?
Well, I think it's going to be pretty big for Microsoft.
This is the competitor for the iPad
it's just so people understand
what we're talking about.
Yeah, the Microsoft Surface. And I think the big game changer that Microsoft is bringing to the table with this specific tablet is the case that actually has a physical keyboard built into it, which, as we were talking off the air earlier, would probably be something you'd be very interested in.
I would be, yeah.
A lot of users, when I'm working with people on iPads, their primary complaint is, I wish I had a keyboard. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of options for them through third parties, and then Apple also provides you can hook up a Bluetooth keyboard, or there's a little case for it. So, I mean, there are options for them. But what Microsoft is doing is they're bringing a physical keyboard that's integrated in with the case, which is really cool looking, and it's a flexible case, kind of like what Apple has for their iPad, if you're familiar with that.
Is this new Surface tablet as big, the same size roughly as the iPad?
Yeah, roughly. It's pretty comparable. They're going to have a couple of different versions. They've just announced pricing for it yesterday or the day before. So they're going to be price competitive with iPads. iPads start out at $499. The Surface is going to start out at $499 as well. That's going to have 32 gigs of storage, which is more than what Apple's entry-level iPad has. Those start out at 16 gigs. So if you store a lot of information on them,
are you able to compare the two products yet, or have we seen enough of the new Surface from Microsoft to really know how they're different and how they're like?
Yeah, I mean, they've spec'd them out. We've been able to see, you know, what kind of processor they're running. I think the big thing that I'm looking forward to doing is actually just getting hands-on with the device, because I still have my doubts that this scaled-down version of Windows 8 that they have running on this tablet is going to provide the same kind of fluid experience that I'm used to from a tablet device.
To some extent, the jury's still out, at least in Justin Parlett world.
Yeah, I mean, until this device comes out. I mean, and everyone knows, it's no secret, I am biased towards Apple products.
Really?
Yeah, I have no – really?
Is that right?
Yeah, no idea.
Newsflash.
Yeah, shocker. But at the same time, I'm fascinated by this new technology, and I really think Microsoft has brought a strong product to market when it launches. I think October 25th?
6th.
The 26th?
Something, yeah. 5th or 6th.
October 25th or 6th is when they're launching this, and I think it's
October
cool.
25th or 26th, yeah. You're saying? You know, Dustin, you can't speak for Microsoft, but why wouldn't Microsoft jerk with the price point here and make it, you know, cheaper as a way to compete with the iPad, which has gotten so much attention?
Well, because they realize that's the competition, that if they were, you know, if they came in at a starting price $100 higher, they knew that nobody would do it.
Well, $100 lower.
Well, no, it's the same price. They actually have more memory. But the interesting thing for me is that, you know, Microsoft is kind of upsetting a lot of their partners because typically Microsoft stays out of the hardware except for Xbox. And they've changed that radically now, where Microsoft is also starting to get into like an iTunes kind of music distribution system. But traditionally, you know, Microsoft is focused on things like, you know, Windows 8. Now all of a sudden they're really starting to jump back into the hardware side, which is, you know, traditionally they'd work with, you know, Lenovo or IBM, you know, whoever, Samsung, out there to run their operating system. Now they're creating hardware, and that's really upsetting a lot of their manufacturing partners. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is pretty interesting.
But they clearly want to get a piece of the Apple.
They're predicting, you know, 3 to 5 million of these sold in Q4 heading into the holidays.
But if the price is the same, the big story here in tech world is going to be, how do these two different units compared to each other, and people are going to want to make a very quick comparison, which one's the better buy.
Yeah.
So Microsoft better have a pretty good product here.
Yeah, and they're really putting a lot of money in. As Dustin mentioned, they're trying to adapt the Apple model, which is we build the hardware and the software, and when we put that together, then hopefully it'll be a very superior product. And I think the biggest weakness that Microsoft has always had, while Windows itself is just a really stellar and pretty stable operating system, where most people run into trouble is one when they have to update or use third-party components to make it work with the hardware. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the big advantage that Apple has is kind of their whole widget. They make everything. They don't make the processors. They don't make some of those bits. But they essentially design the hardware and the software to work together. And that's why you get machines that last a little bit longer, a little bit more stable, because they're just designed. So you don't need – and to a certain degree, you don't need as much horsepower. A lot of my friends will argue with me, oh, your Mac has a slower processor. And my counter to that is, well, it doesn't need to have an overclocked processor because it's designed to work in this environment. And so I think Microsoft is seeing that now because they're kind of getting their clock cleaned – especially in the device market. And they're saying, let's do that. And I think we're going to see a pretty solid device.
So we do know about the new Microsoft Surface tablet that it's got more memory and that for a certain price point, you can get the keyboard integrated into the experience.
The cover. Yeah,
the cover. And
the touch cover. Yeah, that touch cover is $119, $119.99. And then there's one that has hardware keys on it, and that one is $129.99. So, I mean, the covers for them themselves are pretty substantial.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that they're starting out their lowest offering at 32 gig as opposed to Apple having 16 gig, I think people are going to look at that and they're going to maybe put a little bit more importance on that number than they should.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because honestly, how much do we store on our tablets? I've got a 32 gig phone. I used to just have a ton of stuff on that, but now everything that I do
is in
the cloud. Yeah. I do so much of, you know, I used to store a lot of music and photos on there, but now all of that is online. So I don't need that physical storage space as much. So I think that Microsoft is really banking on people looking at that 32 gig number and saying, ooh, that's shinier, when maybe it's not as big of an issue as it would have been even 2 years ago.
Well, again, the new Microsoft Surface tablet comes out later on this month, right?
Yeah.
Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with our techsperts, Dustin Jacobson. He's the Chief Strategy Officer at Flat Square Technology Group, and Justin Parlett, the recently departed Support Systems Administrator here at UMKC, enjoying, I hope, his final broadcast with us here on UpToDate. In our second half today, we'll talk about Internet pirates, more folks working at home, and our technology gadgets of the month. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to UpToDate on KCUR. And we are back. If you missed yesterday's conversation about teenage sexuality with Dr. Wes Crenshaw and our panel of young women, you can find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we review the latest indie, foreign, and documentary films now showing on area screens. This hour, we're visiting with our techsperts. Coming up later in the program, Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Gentlemen, let's move over to pirates. Internet pirates are hanging out on college computer networks. This all has to do with file sharing. What's going on there, Dustin?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that's been going around for a while is that internet and college goes hand in hand, especially when it comes to illegal file sharing. Now, over the last several years, a lot of colleges got in trouble because they were basically not really doing anything about this. But as it turns out, college kids are pretty crafty
really?
And figure out ways to beat the system. It's the whole build a better mousetrap. So they realize when they started getting letters and notices from school administration, hey, we're not going to stop this. We just need to figure out a better way to do what they wanted to do in the first place. So, the schools track everything, track what files you store, what's you share, what you, you know, access. Some schools have more control or more limits or more monitoring in place of that. But ultimately, if they start getting letters from major companies and lawsuits, then they start investing in watching what's going on. And essentially, that's what ultimately has happened. You know, schools starting getting these letters around file sharing, and they started, okay, we should probably take this a little bit more seriously. A lot of schools have very, very high-speed networks. Some of it because of just the research that they do, and Justin could speak to this as well. But when they started getting, you know, kind of these letters and potential fines and millions of dollars, they realized that they needed to do something about it. And when that happened, and when people started realizing that they could potentially get, you know, kind of shaken out of that, then they figured out how they could get around it. Now, there are ways that you can trick the system into not really knowing what you're trying to access. And one of the ways around that is this whole concept of proxies and encrypting what you're sending back and forth. Mm-hmm. So if they can't tell what you're sending or where it's coming from or going to, then all of a sudden their hands are kind of tied in regards to really knowing what's going on.
So it's a dangerous situation for colleges in a way.
Well, to some extent, because they don't know what's being shared or what's being accessed.
Yeah. Okay. Right. How fast are the servers here at UMKC? Is speed how important is speed on a college campus?
Oh, speed is vital.
Yeah.
And the ability to handle a tremendous amount of traffic is also very important. Mm-hmm. There's nothing worse than an instructor who's trying to use a video as part of a lecture and it won't
can't
load because
it.
The network's overloaded. So yeah, that's something that universities take very, very seriously and spend a lot of time and money on. And there's one thing more I wanted to say about the piracy issue, and I think this is interesting because the American Assembly, which is associated with Columbia University, just released a study this week saying that internet pirates are a third more likely to purchase content than people who aren't pirating information. So people who are stealing music online are also more likely to purchase music. So a lot of people are using
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, no. I mean, a lot of people are trying before they buy it. So, you know, oh, that album's great. I'm going to go over to iTunes and pick it up. So it's kind of interesting. And I'll post a link to that up on Twitter so people can see the research. But I think that's pretty interesting that the biggest consumers who are purchasing content legally right now, a lot of them are also pirating content.
Hey, how easy is it to pirate music these days?
I wouldn't know.
Oh, just speaking generally, based on your experience in the world of high tech.
Yeah, as speaking strictly as a tech expert and not someone who would condone such activity, it's very easy. Very, very, very easy.
Really?
Why
is it so easy? I don't get that. Why is it so easy?
Well, and you know, it's because the access is there. People make it available. You know, I joke that when I was young and I wanted to steal a record, I had to put it in my jacket. You know, I mean, and now you can just log on and hop on the internet and do a quick search if you're looking for a record. You know, the new Ben Folds 5 album's out. Well, within 5 seconds, you can find that. It's just a quick Google search away.
But someone, I'm slow. So someone puts it online and makes it available for others just to download it real quickly?
Yep. And then other people offer that up. There are several different ways to do it. There's torrenting, which basically spreads the file out amongst a lot of different computers, and everyone is uploading and downloading little pieces of that file. And then there's direct downloads, where you're essentially doing the exact same model that you have on iTunes, where you want it, so you just click it, and it downloads that file directly to your machine.
And no one's out there policing that stuff.
There are tons of people out there policing it.
Trying.
They're trying desperately, but it's finger in the dam. You know, it's you plug one hole and five open up. So, you know, recently several big file servers were shut down. I think a while back we were talking about the Mega Upload service that was shut down. This was a huge file sharing service. And let's keep in mind that not all file sharing is bad or illegal. I mean, there are plenty of artists who encourage the trading of their music, and there are plenty of legitimate services as well that people use to transfer files. So some people are abusing that system and making files that violate copyright.
I am such a simple man. I go on iTunes and I buy the music. I mean, I just – it's a very simple world, you know?
This is why we love you.
Yeah, well, and that's why iTunes and Apple loves me too,
exactly.
I guess. Yeah.
Well, and I think the brilliant thing – one more little tiny bit on piracy. I think one of the coolest things that Apple has done is they figured out a way to make money off of piracy because they've got their iTunes Match service, which essentially scans your entire music library and – for $25 a year, it allows you to re-download those tracks from the iTunes store. So probably in a much higher quality than when you downloaded it illegally in college. And Apple's making money now off of essentially illegally downloaded content, and at the same time bringing people into a legitimate copy of that song, so artists are getting paid for it. So it's kind of a win-win. People who have that pirated material, or maybe it wasn't pirated, maybe you ripped it from a CD into your library, then you know they found a way to monetize that. And I think that's I think something that we're going to be seeing more and more of in the future, finding ways to legitimize this illegally gotten content and maybe find a way to get some artists paid for it.
You know, given that, and we're going off track here, I've never understood, we've talked about this here before, why iTunes, why you know, retailers sell music for as much as they do, because when you walk into Barnes & Noble and a disc costs you $18.99 and you can go online and buy it used from Amazon for $3, I've never understood that and why that model continues to exist the way it does. And clearly, it's not working because Barnes & Noble's music selection has, you know, dwindled dramatically. It used to be so dramatic.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, it's just amazing.
And digital sales surpassed, I think this was maybe 5 years ago. It was a while ago. But digital sales have far surpassed plastic discs. And you're also seeing at that same time, though, a resurgence in people buying vinyl. So you've got a lot
of
people who are going back to that experience.
Because they want quality.
Yeah, pretty much every record I buy now also comes with a little slip of paper that allows you to download the album off iTunes. So, you know, you spend $20 on an album, you get the great vinyl quality, and then you've got a portable version to throw on your phone or on your computer.
So people are reacting to the poor sound quality that downloads often provide.
Well, and to be honest, I mean, that quality is only getting better. But, I mean, it is compressed music. So to a certain ear, maybe not everyone, but to a certain ear, they're going to notice a little bit of a difference, and they're going to want that audio quality in addition to having a portable version.
If you're just joining us, we're visiting with our tech experts, Dustin Jacobson, Justin Parlett. Dustin, you came across some new numbers when it comes to the number of Americans working at home these days, and surely working at home online. The stat is this, that on the days that they work, 21% of employed persons did some or all of their work at home. I gather that number's going up all the time.
That numbers is definitely going up, and part of that has to do with the shift from desktops to laptops, and as well as smartphones and tablets. So now all of a sudden, you know, employers have realized, a laptop may be more expensive, but in a lot of cases, it's kind of a wash. But what that buys them is that flexibility of, a quick another email at night when I get home, or maybe I'm going to leave early so I can miss traffic and get an hour back per day. But what's happening is so many people now are not disconnecting. So this gets back to our previous point about mobile devices and always available, because employers are encouraging that. Now, that opens up a whole new level of challenge when it comes to security and are these devices really safe and are you accessing from a secure network? So it's opening a whole nother tier of challenges from an IT administrative standpoint, but it's also gaining some productivity back from employees as well. So some of that time that they spent checking Facebook at the office now is regained by a couple hours of email at home
at
night.
That's interesting. You've also found some information about all these big companies gravitating to Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And some companies figure they've got to put so many policies in place first, you know, with compliance officers and folks like that. Why is all this so complicated for bigger businesses, Dustin?
Yeah, so I work with several financial and pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, their challenge is they're in a regulated industry. Everything that they do has to be monitored and archived for 7 years, especially in the medical industry. If someone posts, say, on Facebook, hey, I had a negative experience, and I got sick because I took this medicine, that has huge ramifications. That could, tank a, $500 million research project. So you think at the risk there that they're incurring. And a lot of that legally has to be reported. So if someone says that they took something and got sick, you don't really know if that's true or not. They could just be making it up. So regardless, though, from a safety standpoint, they are required to report that to law. And on the financial side, there's a lot of companies that are trying to figure out, okay, how can we now reach out to customers? But if you're, a bank, there's certain things you can't say. Like you can't guarantee a certain percent return on your investments. And you hear a lot of times, we're FDIC insured, all those kinds of things. So there's a lot of just kind of normal regulation. And now when you take that into a public forum, that opens up a whole nother a whole nother tier of challenges for these organizations.
And Justin, Verizon Wireless has been now selling information about its customers' geographical locations, app usage, web browsing tendencies. This, of course, has raised all kinds of privacy questions and could even brush up against the federal wiretapping law. What's all that about?
Yeah, essentially, if you're doing something on your smartphone, your carrier is able to know what you're doing. And what Verizon this month began doing is they're offering reports to marketers showing what Verizon subscribers are doing on their phones, other mobile devices like tablets, up to and including what apps they're running and what they're using. And Verizon says that it's using this information and linking it to third-party databases. So marketers, which contains information about their gender, age, whether or not they are a sports enthusiast, if they eat out a lot, if they have pets, they're able to give this information to marketers. Bill Diggins, who's the chief for Verizon Wireless Marketing, said, "We're able to view everything that they do, and that's really where data is going. Data is the new oil." So there, it's a very valuable information.
Line.
Yeah,
what
data is the new
line.
Oil. Yeah, and scary as well for people who are concerned. What's going on is several privacy advocates are saying, "Look, you're essentially taking information from someone's phone and you're handing it over to a third party," which technically can run afoul of the Wiretapping
you
Act.
Would think.
Verizon
you would
is
think.
Saying they're okay because they're taking a lot of that data from a lot of users. But
that sounds squishy to me.
Yeah,
the
law doesn't really specify it. So this is something that we'll probably be seeing in court relatively soon.
Dustin, give me your tech gadget of the month.
Yeah, so mine is kind of a life hack. And what I mean by that is it's a way that you can make your life easier. And I've been traveling a lot, also internationally. So, you know, when you travel internationally, you have to pay for these incredibly expensive data plans. So when I was in Australia, I said, okay, how can I get around this? And I use, you know, maps. Obviously, in your foreign country or foreign city, you use maps quite a bit. So what I did was kind of old school was I created my own map. So what I did is I took actually screen captures when I had internet access. So then when I didn't have internet access, then I could then still access all that content. Now, I still had to use a little bit of, you know, figuring out, okay, what street is this and where is that? But essentially what I did is I saved all those photos of the maps into my camera phone, you know, kind of camera roll on my phone so I could actually leverage that when I didn't have data access.
And now, Justin Partlett, your final tech gadget of the month.
My final tech gadget. I tried not to do anything with lasers this time. My final
robots. We already talked about robots.
Right. This is actually kind of a robot. This is a new wheelchair from the Chiba Institute of Technology, and it is a wheelchair that actually can go upstairs and it can climb obstacles.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, there's a video of it. I'll post it up on Twitter so that people can watch it. But it's absolutely fascinating. It has sensors on the feet, which are actually wheels. And the wheels can stabilize, and then it basically has legs that can, as it detects you're coming up to a stair, just kind of pop up, and it stabilizes in the back. And what's really neat is that the end user never tips forward or backwards. It always keeps them stable and level. So this is a really awesome wheelchair. They're probably a good 4 years from having this be out on the market for people, but they're ready now at the point where they're giving it to people in Japan so they can test it out and make sure that it doesn't, you know, explode.
Well, again, the ramifications of something like that for folks who would need something like that, they want to move to a ranch house, they could stay in their own homes.
Exactly.
It's just remarkable,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's fantastic. Yeah. And, you know, the robot can also line wheels up and extend these stabilizers so it can turn in a complete circle, which makes it easier for people to get around in tight spaces, which is just going to be amazing.
Just amazing.
And it's about time we got this.
Yes.
I think this is something long coming.
Well, and it's about time that we say so long to you. And listen, man, you've been great coming in the last couple of years. It's been great to have you. We all wish you the best of luck.
Thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.
You bet. That's Justin Partlett and Dustin Jacobson, our tech experts. All the best to you, Justin.